Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 187 for comics originally released on March 9th, 2011. Starting us off in DC is Booster Gold number 42. I really think they undercut this story with the first two pages, which served kind of as an intro to the actual story itself. But, I mean, the basic thing right now is Booster Gold's origin, is he ripped off a bunch of stuff from the Space Museum, you know, a Legion flight ring, a force field belt, you know, power gauntlets, this, that, and the other, to assemble his suit, stole the Tionosphere, traveled back in time to become a hero in the modern day. That's great. Now he's going to jail for that time. The first two pages here is him getting back from jail so he can tell the story of what happened.
Yeah, it does kind of undercut the suspense because they kind of leave the story off on like a cliffhanger. And it's like, even though you know they're not going to kill the character, you know, well, you know, there being a lot of hype about it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, we figure they're not going to, but they remove even the pretense of that happening.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the kind of thing when you tell it. I would have rather have not seen those two pages, or given that you've seen those two pages, have had the entire story of his time in jail contained in this issue and not have it kind of cliffhanger in the middle because you kind of, okay, like you said, you know how it's going to end out.
I mean, they cannot do any sort of a will he survive or won't he survive part to the jail time story, because they tell us at the beginning, yep, he's fine. And it's like, come on, that's just... I was disappointed with that. When we actually get to this perforated man, which I think is just a really bad name, at first I was thinking he might be Kronos from that short-lived series. Turns out, not the case. But, you know, overall, I thought this was an okay story. It was a bit more serious and, frankly, a bit more far-fetched than kind of some of the blah-ha-ha booster we've been getting recently in this title. And while I thought it was a decent story, it felt a little bit thin on kind of plot points and stuff. It wasn't brilliant. Again, it undercut itself at the beginning. But it wasn't bad.
Yeah, recent issues I've enjoyed more.
Yeah.
Put it that way. And the art on this one also, I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't Chris Bautista and Rich Perotta. Nothing. I like their art. It's just some of the artists that they've had recently have been more of the, wow, I really like the artist kind of variety. And again, mm-hmm. Personal taste.
Yeah, I would not suggest this as like a jumping on point for the series. I think it's going to have definite ramifications on the character. But just the contents of this issue, particularly where it left off versus how it started and stuff, frankly, I was a little disappointed with, but still, I think it was a good, you know, issue. I would say, you know, frankly, it's kind of an average issue. For me, it's a, you know, right there at a 3.
Yeah, nothing pulled it up out of the 3 range for me either. Yeah. It was a good issue. I mean, there have been issues in the last half year that have, to me, been 4s, high 4s, you know, encroaching on, you know, 5. And this just was an okay issue.
Yeah, this was far from a high watermark for this title.
But, you know, when you read a title for a long time, I mean, that's the thing. You have these ups and downs in any series.
Well, and that's true, and that's worth talking about, because I don't mind the ups and downs. I love getting those 5 out of 5 issues on a title where it's just, wow, this is just, everything clicked, it was great, it was perfect. They can't sustain that, and technically, if they do, that becomes kind of average. You know, and while this is lower than some of those points we've been hitting lately, it's still a perfectly good, competent title, or issue, I mean. They had a good story. They introduced the stuff. They gave some payoff. They moved things along. We got a little character moments here and there. You know, if the low point on a series is a 3, that's a really good sign. It's when that low point starts to dive into that 2 or below kind of a thing where it's really actively worse than your average comic. In some way, it's a bit deficient. That's when I start to really have problems, particularly on a title where it seems to bounce between those really low points and those really high points, because if it's that uneven, something's just not right.
Yeah. Yeah, and nothing about Booster has kind of pulled it down to that level. And I'm assuming that the story is going to wrap up with 43, because when we finish the Time Master series, I'm pretty sure that issue 6 of that said something like to be continued in Booster Gold 44, which is not next issue, but the issue after that, which will start the Flashpoint stuff. So I think they're just kind of wrapping this era of the character up, and then we're going to, you know, because Booster, other than the Flash, is the one DC title that's going to be tied. Ongoing title is going to be tied pretty heavily into Flashpoint.
The interesting part with that is I think the solicitation for that issue was along the lines of when Booster returns to Rip Hunter's lab or whatever, it's not the way he left it, but he's already returned from this adventure, so presumably it's returning from somewhere else. But yeah, I think they're going to wrap this up quick. I think this has the potential of helping to mature the character a little, therefore putting him in a better, more heroic, you know, position for Flashpoint. And I agree, you know, it's going to be one of the key titles for that, between this and the Flash. And it could be that it positions him in a much better spot, you know, coming out of Flashpoint as a much more, you know, important character in the DC Universe.
Right.
So, we shall see.
I kind of like the, you know, the greatest hero you've never heard of tagline.
Mm-hmm.
With it, where he's got to kind of do his thing undercover. So it's a good series, but it's certainly one that, and I think, as you said, it's something you have to do with almost any series, is you can't really judge an ongoing series by any one issue. And we've had the same thing, you know, we've reviewed an issue of Fables or something, which is a definite 5 out of 5 series in the long run. And it's like the one issue that we reviewed that one time was, well, I didn't like this one that much. You know, it was an okay issue. But, you know, like you said, ups and downs, and you got to take some samples if you're kind of jumping in the middle. Now, that said, I hold a number one issue to a different kind of a standard, which will segue us into Sigil number one.
Before we dive into Sigil, though, I got one other point on the series versus issue thing.
Okay.
When people were watching Babylon 5 and they'd catch an episode, it's like, yeah, it's good, but what's the big deal? When you'd watch the whole series, it's like, wow, this was really impressive. And at one point, Straczynski, J. Michael Straczynski, you know, the main writer, he wrote like 90 out of the 110 episodes, or, I mean, an astounding number. He referred to that, or somebody had referred to it to him, and he passed it along, as kind of holographic storytelling. And it's one of those things where the dimensionality of the story comes not from any particular episode, even though that tells a certain part of the story, but in that episode in combination of what came before and what came after to kind of give it that dimensionality and stuff. And it's very much a case where a lot of series are really good individual issues, or maybe even not so great individual issues, but when you stack them all together, you layer onto that story and you've gotten it kind of feeding forward and feeding backward on the timeline of the issues and stuff to give it much more depth, much more solidity, and make it, you know, really a 5 out of 5 series, even though maybe the best issue is only a 4 or something like that. Again, we've picked issues out of PS-238, Fables. I think there have been a couple others where it's just, wow, we really love this title, but the individual issue we hit, maybe it wasn't a great jumping on point, maybe it was in the middle of a story, maybe it just didn't click on all cylinders. But even if that's the case, and again, the ratings we're giving are for the individual issue, sometimes those titles are, you know, head and shoulders above any individual issue in that. So,
right.
Just because it's the history, the continuity, all of that can really build into something bigger than any issue.
And before I get specifically into Sigil, what I was kind of going at with, you know, the segue was, I think that's true on when you're jumping on in the middle of a series, because you might hit, you know, one of the valleys in the peak and valley system there.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a number one issue, it really is important, because that's going to be a jumping on point for everybody for the most part. It's really important that you pull out all the stops and make sure that your number one issue is a peak.
Agreed, because that sets the tone for the series.
Exactly. And that's what I wanted to get to there is, you know, it's like when I am always going to be making a decision when I buy a number one issue, if I'm going to be, you know, automatically adding this title to my buy list, if I'm going to drop it, or if I'm going to kind of look at it and say, well, you know, I'll give it another couple of issues. It was okay. And as much as possible, a creator is going to want to make sure that their number one issue puts it on that automatic buy, adding it to the pull list kind of category. You know, so that the way you craft the number one issue, to me, should be very different than just an issue of an ongoing series.
Well, I agree entirely. It has to be, because you can have just an average issue in the middle of an ongoing, and people will continue just out of inertia to a degree. If you have just an average, or worse yet, a below average first issue, people aren't going to continue with that title. There is no inertia to benefit from. That's important not just for the first issue of a title, even more so for the first issue of a property, or the first issue out of a group of titles, or an imprint, or whatever, and unbelievably important for the first issue published by a publisher. Because when you get to the, at a publisher level, if it's the first thing, you know, a new publisher so-and-so is coming out with, that, to a large degree, sets the high watermark and the expectation for how sales are going to be for everything else out of that publisher. You know, and I've definitely seen that with some of the publishers that have come and gone over recent years. I think it was Virgin Comics that started with a couple of things that really didn't, I mean, just at the face of it, you wouldn't expect it to click with an American audience, because they're going for a more international, or were going for a more international feel. Yet they had a few things later on that, if they had started with some of those properties, would have set the level a bit higher for that company. Likewise, I think we've seen that with, again, more than just that one publisher.
Yep.
So I think with Sigil number one, not only is the bar set a little higher because it's a first issue, but it's also the first issue of this Sigil property and the first issue of this new cross-gen universe. So if they were to come out with something that was really, oh my god, this just stinks six ways to Sunday and stuff, they would be setting that whole cross-gen universe, you know, really setting it back significantly. Fortunately, I don't think that was necessarily the case here. But certainly this also isn't the old cross-gen. So they've got both the problems of, okay, can we set up a new character, a new title, a new universe, yet they're also going to be up against comparisons of, well, how did this compare to, again, the old cross-gen stuff?
Right.
So what did you think of this?
I had really mixed feelings about it. I like the art, but the story, because I'm going into this with a different set of perceptions, because I read the original cross-gen stuff and I really liked it. Now, I understand that that's not necessarily going to be the typical fan of this, because, you know, most Marvel fans who might try this out have never picked up one of the cross-gen issues before. So, you know, right off, I saw pretty much no relationship to the old property. So I just kind of set my mind frame on it. Okay, I'm just going to look at this as it's a completely new thing that has nothing to do with the previous Sigil series. I mean, they're doing little tags here and there. I mean, the pirate part of the episode, I mean, it's like it's going back to the, you know, not
the
really,
El Cazador,
but I mean, it has nothing to do with that other than the name either. You know,
Captain has the same name too.
Yeah, but it's not the same. You know, it's just not the same, right? So, I mean, I think that they're kind of using the names and maybe kind of framework, but it's not the same thing. So, from that respect, it's good because it's a good jumping on point for a new reader. Now, looking at this issue specifically as a first issue of a series and how it's going to pull me in personally to the story, I thought that the story had a lot more teen angst and a lot less forward story momentum than I would have liked to see to pull me into this series.
Interesting.
I would have liked to see a lot less of the girl talking to her mother's gravestone, getting chased around the school bathroom, taking tests and eating in the cafeteria, and, you know, gotten a little bit more into the action elements of the story. Again, that's just me.
From my perspective, I mean, clearly this isn't the old CrossGen universe. This is a reimagining both of the property and clearly the overall universe, with aspects of kind of the broad brushstrokes of the original CrossGen universe still visible. You know, one aspect of that with this particular title is the whole notion of sigil bearers being kind of found, gathered, and led. Now, in the original sigil series, it was by Samadol Ray, who was going to be that leader of the sigil bearers, and he had a little bit of a different sigil to kind of represent that. Now, clearly, this Samantha Ray, totally different character than that original character in that sigil title. This one kind of reminds me more of the lead character from Meridian in some respects. Basically, younger girl, again, bit of the teen angst. I cannot disagree that aspects of this issue felt a little slow at the start, particularly all the time in the school setting up the character, but I think that was needed to kind of establish she does need a bit of an escape from where she's at to go do other stuff. She's at the beginning of her journey with the sigil and stuff. She's having these dreams, so she's got, I mean, using those dreams and some of that stuff set up the there are other sigils, bearers and stuff, there's a history of this, there's, you know, all that. So I thought that, and even that had echoes of the original sigil series, because it was Samadol Ray who actually crossed over into the Meridian title to go visit that character, and kind of is the flip side of in some respects, what we're getting here, but also very similar to what we're getting here, of his first jump in time, I think, was to an old, you know, ship, although it was an airship, not a watership, whatever. So I think they're leveraging aspects of what they felt worked in the original CrossGen universe, tweaking it, making it, you know, their own. Again, the whole El Cazador thing with Captain Sin and whatever, obviously it's a very different take on that than the Chuck Dixon title. Lasted about 6 issues or whatever. But it's kind of a nice nod in that direction. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, are we going to get some of the other CrossGen characters popping up here and there or not? But just having those short nods and stuff already gives it the impression of this is kind of, big picture-wise, the full CrossGen universe is out there. We're just getting this small 4-issue window into it and just getting some teased of some other stuff they could be doing. While the start of the issue was a little slow and some of the high school stuff, you know, delved into to a lot more of the issue than, you know, maybe I would have preferred. Again, I thought it was needed. It set up the character. I felt I got to know Sam Ray by the end. So when she got onto that ship and was in this, you know, okay, now what situation, you know, I was, you know, able to follow her and be kind of right there with her or whatever. Not just plunk, she gets dropped into that, and I'm like, who is she? Why should I care? I thought this was, overall, a really good first issue, both for this series and for this new CrossGen universe. I thought it set it off on a fairly good footing. Again, I can't disagree with the whole teen angst is a heavy aspect of this part, of this issue, at least. But for me, this was noticeably above average, and I felt very satisfied with this issue, both as a standalone, as the first issue of Sigil, and the first issue of the new CrossGen universe.
I wish I had liked it that much. I came out of this with, do I really want to read any more of this, personally? And it's like, well, it's only a 4-issue series, so I guess I will stick it out. If it was an ongoing, I would have likely dropped it.
Wow, okay.
I just, for me, when you take an existing property and just take the names and then do something completely different with it, it's why not just do something completely new?
That's where I don't think they just... I think that's where we differ, because I don't think they just took the names. I think they took a lot of the concepts behind it and are leveraging those. You know, to me, it's entirely possible that we're either going to see the original Samad Al-Rey as the leader of a group of sigil bearers down the line, or this Samantha Ray is going to be that leader in place of that original character. So I'm not as convinced that this is just a, okay, we just kept a couple of names. Part of what I also liked on this is because they did tweak some stuff. Okay, she has it branded on her like a birthmark. One of these other guys has like this medallion with it.
Right.
So okay, so the sigil isn't necessarily a tattoo-ish sort of a thing or whatever. It's clearly worked differently. And to me, that gives it stuff to speculate about. Okay, how does that work? How does this play out? What does that mean? Are some sigil bearers more than others because of that? But I can see where you're coming from in terms
And they redesigned the sigil.
I think they had to do that. And I'm okay with that.
I guess they had to do that. I mean, it felt to me like when Hollywood makes a movie and they just change stuff to change it, it feels like, you know, to kind of make it their own. That's what a lot of the changes felt like. It just felt like we're going to change stuff because we want to make it different from what it was. And I think that's fine. I have a hard time because I'm coming from a standpoint of I really, really loved the old cross-gen stuff so much so that it's going to hit me differently than a completely new audience. So it's really hard for me to be completely objective about all the changes that they made.
I mean, I read all the cross-gen stuff when it was coming out. I was a huge fan of that stuff. So I think I'm right there with you with that love of the old cross-gen stuff. But for me, that's enhancing some of this, not taking it away. And yes, they're doing a completely reimagining of it. It's a very different take, and if you see it as sacrilegious or whatever, I can understand.
I'm not
that.
Saying it as sacrilegious. I'm just saying that it didn't hit me the right way.
And that's
fair. I didn't feel betrayed or anything. I just felt like maybe I'm not the target audience personally for this. And again, I don't know what it was about it. It's something kind of indefinable, because I don't mind the way that they do the like kind of the teen angsty part of Spider-Girl, right?
Or but, say Ultimate Comics Spider-Man, because a lot of this, if you replaced Sam Ray with Peter Parker, we could have been reading the first issue of Ultimate Spider-Man at times.
Yeah, certain times it'll hit me one way, and in this one it just. It kind of felt like it dragged it down a little bit for me, because, I mean, there were so many pages of it. And I can understand setting up the character, but, you know, the pages with that versus the pages where some actual action happened was so much skewed in the one direction. It just, the pacing to me didn't work for me.
I agree with the pacing. There were aspects of this issue that did feel slow to me because of that. But it also gave the series a little bit of a Amethyst of Princess of the Gem World feel to it. She's a normal teenager on Earth, but she can go to this other place and be this magical character or whatever. So I think that it may just be that, you know, again, that doesn't strike the right chords with you. Other people, it will.
Right.
As far as the actual sigil design, since that was a cross-gen trademark, presumably they have access to that, but I think changing it was a really smart idea to clearly differentiate it from the original cross-gen universe visually. Whether it crosses over to that and they retroactively had now that sigil, if we ever see those older characters, remains to be seen. But it's a clear way of telling fans, you know, this is not just a continuation of the old titles. Now, whether that's going to still be true with, say, Ruse is another matter.
Yeah, I'll be really curious to see how much that one changes.
I mean, for me, this was a 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to, you know, future issues.
It was a 3 out of 5 for me.
Fair enough. Shall we move on to Guarding the Globe number 4?
Sure.
This is one of those titles where, because the series is running late, it's kind of killed a bit of the story momentum, and it's hard for me to kind of stay in the story when it goes quite a few months between installments. I mean, the first one came out back in August of last year, and it's been almost like bi-monthly since. And there's an aspect of this particular issue where it almost feels like we were getting the Cliff Notes version of the story, kind of the, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens aspect of it. A lot of action, but no particular sense of plot direction or progress. I didn't feel really connected to a lot of the characters, but part of it is it's not just a team book, it's a team book of a really huge global team. So there's just too many characters, and only like two or three got any kind of true definition here, and it came down to like, okay, Cooper Cabra, he's the down-and-out drunk. Britt, he's the de facto leader, and he's mad at Cooper Cabra for being a down-and-out drunk. You know, most of the rest were, okay, she's got wings, that character runs fast, this one's a Yeti or whatever, and kind of almost to the caricature level, in terms of level of characterization we get, and almost seemed like generic cannon fodder. Now, granted, a lot of these get a lot more characterization in the other issues, but because of the time between the issues, it's hard for that to really stick in my mind. The story's not bad, but I didn't feel connected to it. It seemed to lack a reason in this issue for me to care about most of those characters. This is something that I think if I were to read it in rapid succession, in trade or whatever, would do better for me. Just because I don't think the issues have the accessibility, the resetting of the scene, and some of those aspects that it really needs. What did you think?
To some extent, I agree. The slowness of this coming out, and this is something that happens with a lot of these mega delayed comics. You know, like Old Man Logan. I mean, there's lots of them that come out with huge gaps in between issues, and it's difficult to keep and juggle a lot of things in your head when they're jumping to a completely different set of characters that you're not really familiar with. It's like, you know, if it's Booster Gold that you have a long delay between issues, I mean, there's not that big of a cast in the book. You know, there's not that much to kind of hold in your head. Plus, you're familiar with Booster because he's been around a long time. You might be able to deal with the long delay on something like that a little better. But like you said, I mean, here you got this huge cast of characters that, for the most part, are new. You haven't seen them before. You know, you've seen Britt before, and you've seen a couple of these characters before. But, you know, a lot of them, it's just like, you know, what's the deal with this character again? And it's just kind of tough. You know, it's like, I like a lot of the characters. I mean, some of them, you know, Yeti, I think he's kind of a funny character, you know, the big grin and everything that he's got. That little French bulldog or pug dog, whatever the heck he is, that one, I don't know what the deal is with that one. He's funny. It's like that, the winged girl, what does she call, like Pegasus or something like that? Or
I don't think so.
You know, she can apparently understand his barking, kind of like a Rocket Raccoon understands, you know, when Groot says, "I am Groot," which is, you know, sort of entertaining. But, you know, as you said, when the through story on a lot of the characterization and stuff, I kind of lost track of some of that. But I do like, I mean, there's a lot of new and interesting characters that I'd like to see more development from. I kind of lose some of that.
For me, there are a lot of new characters. I don't know that I have enough to really say that they're interesting. I mean, take, for example, this Best Tiger that gets introduced here on the first, you know, two or three pages or whatever. He's got guns. He's got a lot of pouches on his belt or whatever. And with one bullet, he's able to kill 7 people after 4 ricochets or whatever. And the bullet still seems intact. I'm like, wow, that's one durable bullet. Okay, so he's a marksman and a really tough guy. Man, a few words. Really, what's his motivation? Why is he doing this? What's going on here? You know what I mean? what could have been a cool character if it had been actually fleshed out or presented a little better, just kind of came out as a little bit of a puzzle. And we've
he's kind of a standard template superhero, right? And I'm not as interested in him. With ones I like, Yeti, I was more interested in. I like that little dog guy, Japan droid. That's like a little girl. I mean, there's some that are just newer and more interesting that just from seeing them, I mean, again, there's not that much characterization, I'll give you that, but they're different enough from other ones that I kind of want to know more about them. I'm not saying that I do know more about them because there's not that much development for them.
But it seems like a lot of those are just the broad brush strokes, and if we didn't have the press conference at the beginning to introduce these characters or some other way to do that, I mean, Japan droids' powers, abilities, or whatever are really kind of nebulous and almost, you know, defined on the fly or whatever. And I'm not saying they need to, okay, Japan droid can do this, 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 and this. But it's like, anytime that character shows up, all bets are off because she could do whatever she needs to. It just seems like there is a...
I don't disagree with you at all. I'm not arguing that point. I'm just saying that the broad caricature level of those characters interests me. I think it's kind of a neat concept, and I don't know more about them, but I want to know more about some of the characters. They're not giving me that.
Well, and I think there's no reason to think we're ever going to get it.
But none of that detracts from the point that the character seems interesting from me, and I want to know more about them.
And that's cool. I guess for me, it does detract because I'm frustrated that all we get is a panel here, a panel there, once in a while, and it's so disconnected that, you know, I feel like even if I am interested in learning more about some of these characters, the reality is, because they're in an overloaded team book that comes out too infrequently, I'm never going to learn anything more about them. So for me, that worked against the book.
I have a feeling that we're rushing towards the same grade, but for different reasons. I mean, while I like those characters, I still gave the book a 3.
I was between a low 3 and a high 2.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I gave the book a 3 because, you know, while the infrequency and lack of characterization is kind of pulling it down, the fact that there are a handful of characters that I think are cool just on their little blurb, you know, like when I see when one of these companies puts out a sketchbook about a new series, you just see like that one pinup with like a sentence about a character. Sometimes I'll see a character that and I'll say, oh, that's a cool looking character, I want to know more about it. And I got several of those in this, you know, just like the character design or something. It was enough to counterbalance the other part and keep it from going down to a 2. Let's put it that way. It's just, if it stayed at a 3 for me. I really wish that they would get the issues out with a little more frequency. I just can't feel that, you know, Kirkman is really overextending himself with all the stuff that he's doing. And, you know, he either needs to stop doing so many comics or try to just have somebody else do them. Like when he handed Britt over to, who was it, Brian Brown to write. And, you know, he kind of was editor and kind of kept an eye on it.
He's got a co-writer on this.
Yeah, well, I just don't know how much Benito is running with it in his absence. I mean, I don't know. I mean, is it the fact that this comes out so infrequently because these artists can't draw it that fast? Because Benito can't co-write it that fast? I have a feeling it's because Kirkman can't get his part of the thing done.
The long and short of it is, truly, is that the series artist needs a little more time to give it 110% of their best work to the book. That was at the beginning of the letter page. So they're saying it's the artists, and that next time around they're going to try to deal with that a little bit better.
Okay. I did not read that, but, you know, that...
I skimmed it. That was... Because I was curious, too. I mean, what are the delays here? And it's easy to kind of throw it on the artist and stuff, but... Even delays aside, just this issue, regardless of when the previous ones had come out, had a Cliff Notes version, high level, rapid fire, little bits and pieces here and there, and it gave it a very jumpy feel at times. Okay, and now we've got a moon base, and now these people are in Utah. Now they're stationed over in this place, and now they're over here. You know, kind of a chaotic thing. And while there are a lot of things that I think did not serve the title or the issue well, it's not one of those where I feel it is so awful that I have to give it the 2, but it's one of those that if I give it that 3, this is about as low as a comic can get and still get that. Because a lot of these characters I didn't feel connected to, regardless of how much I know about them. You know, the only ones that really have any kind of major presence in this story, even though a lot of them are in it, are Britt and Cooper Cabra. And Cooper Cabra's set up as a, why could we possibly like him? And Britt is fairly unlikable because all he's doing is yelling at the one guy. So,
not one of Britt's more shining moments.
Not at all.
I normally, Britt's a character I really like, and this issue, it's like it could have been anybody. It didn't even feel like in character of Britt from other places that I've read him.
And that's one of the issues I'm having, is it feels like this is a generic team book. And they're as unique as some of these characters look, and at times, you know, act here and there. We get so little of that in this issue that I was not pleased. I'm going to be a little bit charitable. I'm going to give this the 3. But again, for me, that's, if it had anything else that I had actively said, ooh, that's bad, I'd feel obligated to give it that 2. But it's right there on that border. I'm going to say that maybe I'm being a little harsh just because of the delays, but even just as that single issue, I think the story needed another go-round on the editing or the rewriting pass.
Well, now that you point out, I mean, I'm not going to change my grade on it, but I mean, when you point out the thing about the art there, where they're kind of pinning it on the artists, I'm all for giving new artists a shot. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I don't know what kind of a track record these guys have, but the art in this was okay art, but it did not blow me away to the point that I need to sit around waiting several months for these guys to turn in this kind of art for the book. It was okay art, but I mean, it's like, if these guys can't do a monthly book, there's plenty of artists out there who can do work at least as good as this, if not better, that I think can turn out a monthly book. You know, pick a different artist.
Well,
I'm sorry, that's kind of harsh, but it's the reality of the matter, because I think the infrequency of the book is physically hurting it if you're doing that because some new artists can't turn out a book on a regular basis. Go find a different art team.
And I agree with that. If you flip to the staple for a second, the art here, regardless of quality, is busy. And that, I think, has contributed a lot to my feeling of it's just kind of a chaotic issue. But also, not just the line work having a lot of detail, maybe more than it needs, whatever, including the dead Rick Grimes and other cast of the Walking Dead on that page on the left there. But the coloring doesn't really set up the foreground, the background. It doesn't guide your eye to the important parts of the panel. So, you know, while I don't think these artists are worth waiting for, I think a case could be made that this coloring team is worth replacing. Because I think there are places they could have and should have done a bit better job on the coloring to guide our eyes to the important parts of the panel and make things seem a bit less chaotic. So hopefully the series will improve on the final 2 issues. Hopefully, when they go for another one of these, which the letter page implies they will have given the artist plenty of time, have the art in hand before soliciting, and we won't have these kinds of delays.
Yeah. I want to comment on a couple. I mean, I read a bunch of books. There's only a couple that I felt like I wanted to really call out this time. I'm going to look at 2. There were several things I read, and I commented about them on the forum already. If you go out to the first issue challenge thread and some of those other places, so I don't really need to kind of bang the drum on it. I got two number ones, though, that I wanted to call out. One, Venom, number one. You know, because we've been talking about the previous appearances of Venom in the Spider-Man issues, and so now the actual number one hit the stands here. I like Tony Moore's art. You know, I'm a big fan of Tony Moore, but the story here, I mean, I got to say, I liked the two issues that I saw of Venom previous to this more than I liked this number one.
I was in the same boat on that.
It just, something about it here, I was expecting a certain thing and it's just, I didn't get it. Maybe it's just, I don't know. I like Tony Moore's art in general, but I don't know how well it was working for me on this series. I mean, I liked him when he originally did Walking Dead. I like Fear Agent. You know, I'm just, you know, mainstream Marvel character as much as, you know, Venom, you know, it's kind of like a fringe Marvel character. It just kind of had a, I don't know, help me out here. It's just, you know, just something about it. Kinda.
I think there were a couple of things that worked against the first issue of Venom. One, the fact it wasn't truly the first issue. That was the Amazing Spider-Man 654.1. And even that wasn't the first part of Venom, because that was the backup feature of the previous issue of 654 of Amazing Spider-Man. All of those have, because it's Amazing Spider-Man, a bit more of a bright, uplifting, daylight kind of a look to it. One of the choices they made on this was all of the borders on the art pages are black. It takes place at night. It's a Black Ops kind of a thing. That gives it a much more of a downer kind of feel to it and sets it visually very much apart on a subtle level from the previous issues. So it has a very different feel to it going in. You know, they have a couple of things like these UN peacekeepers powered by Stark armor and stuff. And I'm like, why have we never seen these before? And that kind of flies in the face of some of what we've had going on over in the Iron Man stuff. This did not play as well for me as it could have. It worked okay, but it's the sort of thing where doing this as an ongoing, I think, was optimistic. I don't really see this lasting past, say, 12 issues. Both because of that's the kind of marketplace we're in these days, and frankly, I don't think it's going to click with a lot of readers.
I'll be curious on that, because, you know, there are a lot of people who are, at least when you, you know, look around, you know, they're like big Rick Remender fans, they're big Tony Moore fans. One would expect to hear just lots of people raving about how great this is when you kind of take two great creators and put them together.
I think if they were doing something, say, at Image or some other thing that was creator-owned, you'd be having that buzz.
Yeah.
The fact that this is a mainstream, because I'm going to say it's a mainstream Marvel property.
Yeah.
They've done tons of Venom series before, including an 18-issue ongoing and stuff, and the level of fans that these guys have would be plenty to sustain a book over at Image or something like that. Is a drop in the bucket of what it needs to do over at Marvel. So even if all of their fans of Remender and Moore were separate people, and I think there's going to be a ton of overlap, that's going to be, say, 15,000 to 20,000 each. So best case, this thing could sustain maybe 40,000, you know, non-overlapping sales or whatever from those guys, which, of course, not going to happen because of the fan base, yada, yada, yada. I'm just pulling some numbers out in theory. And I'm not saying their fan base is that big or that small. I'm just, again, guessing on that. But this is a title that what's going to happen is the first issue is going to do really well. Man, I think it's going to plummet on that second issue and then do some attrition going forward. And that's no fault of these guys, because I think the way Marvel solicited this and then kind of preempted it through Amazing Spider-Man worked against this issue.
Yeah. You know what it really did? It felt to me like Fear Agent, which is not a bad thing if I'm reading Fear Agent, right?
But if you're not reading Fear Agent, and
this over-the-top genocidal guy in the tank, I mean, when I'm looking back at that, I think maybe there's some things like that that I was trying to kind of get, you know, the way he's like drawn and he's like all crazed and, you know, it just, it's the kind of tongue in cheek, you know, how he's like kind of just ranting and stuff. It just didn't feel as much to me like a mainstream Marvel book. And again, that's something that's just very situational. You know, you kind of go into a book kind of expecting a certain thing, and when it comes in slightly off kilter from that, it'll hit you. You know, if you personally are expecting A and you get not necessarily B, but you get like kind of A prime, you know, where it's like a little bit out of phase, it kind of just something there is kind of rubbing at you as you're reading it. And that's kind of how I felt, especially given the fact that I read those other two Venom issues by a different creative team. I'm almost feeling like if this had really been the first issue and I hadn't read those, I wouldn't have had that other expectation in my head, and I might have been able to kind of just roll with this a little easier.
I can see that. I would totally agree with that. Because this would have actually felt like a first issue. We would have felt like we'd been getting introduced to the new Venom. Versus, okay, we've already seen some of this before.
Yeah. And then the other one, just kind of throw out there, I know it's not one you read, Punisher Max. They finished the Bullseye storyline. This book, this is some of the greatest Punisher. It's just Jason Aaron and Steve Dillon are just doing do a great job on this version of the Punisher. Now, mainstream Punisher, I'm kind of looking forward to, you know, what we get there, because that one is going to be coming back as part of this next rev of, what are they calling the latest Marvel Knights thing?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it's I don't remember the catchphrase they have for it. But, you know, they're bringing back Punisher with Greg Rucka and Marco Cecchetto. And, you know, they're also going to be bringing Daredevil back with Mark Waid writing it and Paolo Rivera on the art. You know, so they're kind of redoing a lot of these kind of street-level type of Marvel heroes with some pretty high-profile creative, you know, writers on them. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how that's going to go. And it might actually get me into the 616 Marvel a little, or Punisher a little more. I mean, but I've really been enjoying the Punisher Max. I never really kind of hooked up with Remender's Punisher, his 616 Punisher. But I'm looking forward to the Rucka take. But anyone who's a Punisher fan that has not checked out Punisher Max, I mean, and it's a little violent, you know, because it's Max, right? But just crazy thrill ride of, you know, the 11 issues that came out of this series so far. A little infrequent, too. So, you know, now that it's out, and they'll probably do some trades on it, it's worth checking out if you're a fan of that kind of stuff.
Cool.
That was all. I mean, I didn't want to go into everything else, but
yeah. Well, I mean, realistically, we can't do that every week because I got like, you know, 39 comics this week.
Right.
So take out the three we discussed. That's another three dozen and stuff. And frankly, I haven't read all of them. I still got quite a few left to do.
I just wanted to talk about Punisher. I mean, Venom rather, because we had been talking about that recently. So
yeah.
It was worth bringing up.
No, that I completely agree with that. I, again, had mixed feelings on that. It visually was a lot darker and so forth, and I think your description of it's essentially as if it were a Fear Agent issue to a degree, very apt and on the mark. So, anything else?
Sure, no, that'll do it. Like I said, and I like Fear Agent. It's just, you know, I almost...
But if you're going to read Fear Agent, not another character acting like Fear Agent.
But, you know, the real funny part about that is, you know, if you take these same two guys and they're doing Fear Agent, and to my sensibility, it's better because it's something that is Remender's own and it's highly original, and I love that series. A fraction of the people, you know, will read Fear Agent versus who'll read the same two creators doing this take on Venom, which, you know, personally, and again, it's just personal taste, I don't think it's as good as when they do Fear Agent. But, you know, this will sell 5 to 10 times as many copies as them doing an issue of Fear Agent, because it's a Marvel character.
At least initially. I think it's going to quickly get down to that level of how Fear Agent was starting to do. I mean, or the higher level of sales for Fear Agent, I should say. I really think that, you know, over the course of the year, it's just going to peter out in sales big time.
So, but anyone who likes this, though, go seek out a Fear Agent trade paperback by these guys, because you'll love that, you know, I think, if you like this.
Cool. And I'd be interested in hearing what our listeners have to think on Sigil and stuff, too. If it's working for them, if they were a fan of CrossGen before or not.
Yeah.
So that do it?
Yep.
Awesome.
Join us next week when we discuss Zombie number 1 from DC, Ruse number 1 from Marvel, and The Death of Zorro number 1 from Dynamite.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.